Solitaire Rose Radio, episode 37, A Personal History of Spaghetti Westerns. I know you're probably listening to this podcast and saying, this is a comic book podcast. What does it have to do with spaghetti westerns? Well, as I've said a number of times, Solitaire Rose Radio is going to be about stories. And some of them are stories that I'm interested in. Some of them are stories that I like. Some of them are people that I find interesting. This one is about spaghetti westerns. It's a genre of film, very specific genre, that I have a lot of affection for. If you've heard the theme to this episode, that is actually the theme from one of my favorite spaghetti westerns called Return of Sabata, starring Lee Van Cleef, who was in tons and tons and tons of spaghetti westerns. A lot of people, when you think spaghetti western music, you think the theme to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And you should. It's an iconic theme, and Enrico Morricone's music in the spaghetti western is one of the things that helped define the genre, to the point where a number of other conductors and composers would take the sort of music that he did and use it for their own. A lot of spaghetti western music sounds a lot like Enrico Morricone. I have a personal connection to the spaghetti western. As a kid, I didn't care for westerns. I don't know what it was. I don't know why. I was drawn to science fiction and fantasy over westerns. I just wasn't drawn to westerns. The good thing was, I think westerns were kind of out of vogue with kids at the time. We didn't play a lot of cowboys and Indians. We played Star Trek a lot. Played a lot of Star Trek. My father worked two jobs. He ran a 180-acre farm with river bottom land that he would plant corn and soybeans. We also had cows. We had pigs. We had horses. And he worked both of those things. So it was rare that I would see him. He would be very busy. I think through a lot of my childhood, he worked second shift, which was he would leave for work and have to be there at 4 and work until midnight. So he would be leaving for work before I got home from school. He would get home at midnight, go to bed when he got home, and my mom would be the ones to wake us up and send us on our way. So I don't have a lot of memories of my father when I was very young, but I do remember whenever the movie The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly would be on the ABC Sunday night movie, and it was long. With commercials and everything, it would run almost 4 hours, to the point where I think they put it in a 4-hour slot, because the movie itself is like two hours and 47 minutes. So if it wasn't a 4-hour slot, it was at least a 3.5-hour slot. He would make it a big deal. We wouldn't eat supper. Instead, Mom would make bowls of popcorn. They would make this huge monster bowl of popcorn, and each of us would get cereal bowls, and we would have our own popcorn. And I don't remember if we had soda or not, but it was a night at the movies. Dad thought that The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly was important for us to watch, myself and my two younger sisters. And now when I think back on it, and I go, huh, I don't think that's a movie for kids. But you know, it was on ABC TV. They cleaned stuff up. Who knows, maybe it was a 3-hour slot because they edited stuff out. It's hard to know. It would be the long beginning, and then it would be my dad, you know, okay, who do you think's the good? Who do you think's the bad? And who do you think's the ugly? And I enjoyed that movie, and I don't know at the time if it's I enjoyed the movie because it was a movie or enjoyed the movie because it was with my dad. But so much of that movie kind of seeped in over the years that every time I see it, there are things where I, you know, you see scenes and you may not remember the entire movie, but you remember that scene from your childhood, whether it was something shocking or something beautiful or whatever. You know, we're watching it on a 25-inch color TV, and it's not like they did letterboxing. No, they did the pan and scan. That was kind of the only Western I really saw until I went to college. And in college, I was I switched from a math minor once I got to a point where the math wasn't coming easy to me anymore, and my junior year of college was a really bad academic year. I had a lot of stuff kind of blow up on me. So I changed my minor to something I knew that I could raise my grades up really fast and enjoy. So I changed my minor to English with emphasis on film. It's like I could watch movies and write about movies and get class credit for it. And I was also writing movie reviews for the campus newspaper. And because I also worked in a movie theater, I was the janitor and kind of jack of all trades. Because I had that background, pretty much every movie that came to town I got to see before it came out, because I worked at the theater that showed, that had two of the screens, and the other theater I could go to on Friday or Saturday. I reviewed every movie that came to town the entire time I was in college, except maybe the first 6 months. So, in one of the film classes, yeah, we're going through and we get to the period of Westerns, and we learn about John Ford, and we learn about the Western boom. We didn't watch a lot of Westerns in that class, and we didn't watch any of the spaghettis. And I remember the teacher at the time, you know, someone asked about the spaghetti Western and the good, the bad, and the ugly and those. And it's, all those were exploitation films. We're not going to study those. This was, what, mid-80s, and they were dismissed out of hand as just being exploitation films. Well, I kind of had a thing in my head. I loved exploitation films. I'd read books about different exploitation genres and everything. And I actually found one that had a chapter or two on the spaghetti Western. And it talked about how they were made cheap. They were made fast. They were made by Italian filmmakers. They had an international cast. They would come to the U.S. and other than a fistful of dollars, a few dollars more, The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, and maybe a few others, most of them ran in drive-ins and grindhouse theaters. And they didn't spend a lot of time on them either. And the other thing from that period that I remember was that there were a couple of them in the book The 50 Worst Films Ever Made, which was by Michael Medved and his brother, which was, you know, this book that mocked really bad movies. It was kind of the movie that kick-started the love and appreciation people had for Ed Wood's films, because the worst movie, you know, the worst movie ever made was Plan 9 from Outer Space. I couldn't disagree with that more. Plan 9 from Outer Space is not the worst movie ever made. It may be one of the most incompetent, but at least it's entertaining. Manos, Hands of Fate, if you ever try to watch that without Mystery Science Theater 3000, completely unwatchable. Utterly unwatchable. Most boring time you will ever have in a theater. However, a lot of so-called great films I find boring. Terms of Endearment, which won awards, I find it boring. The Nicholas Sparks movies I find boring. Plan 9 from Outer Space may not be competent, but it's not boring. But it really wasn't until I was living in Minnesota and there was a theater called Oak Street Theater, which was a little tiny theater on the U of M campus, and it started showing revival films. Now, other people who lived here talked about how the Uptown was kind of the revival theater. However, by the time I moved here, independent films had grown to the point where the Uptown would show independent films. That's where I saw Time Me Up, Time Me Down. It's where I saw Sex, Lies, and Videotape. It's where I saw Pulp Fiction, actually. Pulp Fiction played there for a month before it moved to the mega theaters and the mall theaters. So they were doing a really good business with indie films, and they weren't doing a lot of revival stuff. When a new print would come out, the Uptown would show it, but there was usually, you know, we have a new print of this, and it would be a big deal, and it would tour. But Oak Street was a revival theater. They would show double features, or they would have themes, and I would get that flyer every 3 months. Okay, here's what's coming for the next 3 months. And they announced that they were going to show Fistful of Dollars, a few dollars more, and the new longer cut of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. They would show the Italian version. It was kind of a big deal because Lee Van Cleef had died. Eli Wallach was still alive and could do a passable Lee Van Cleef impersonation. I would have to look it up, but that's what I remember. That's why it's the Solitaire Rose history and not the definitive history. But they had dubbed Lee Van Cleef because the portions of the film he was in that hadn't been shown in the U.S. were never translated into English. And it was a much longer film, and it was a thing where we're going to show all three. And I was working at a group home where your shift would start, on the weekends you'd have a 24-hour shift. And I worked a lot of them, but I would look in Oak Street's thing to see, oh, I want to go see these movies. I'm not going to sign up to work this weekend. Yeah, that's how dedicated I was to this revival theater. Sadly, they faded away over the last decade or so. Every so often, they open up, and there are spurts of activity. But after they kind of quit being a revival theater and started showing foreign films, and I don't mean, you know, foreign films that, you know, that Iranian films and films from Kuwait and things that cater to a very, very, very small audience that they thought was there and wasn't. Anyway, I go to the theater for the Dollars trilogy. Fistful of Dollars, a few dollars more, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And it wasn't packed, but it was kind of full. And it started in mid-afternoon and went till 10 at night because, you know, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, this cut was over 3 hours long. And they had a deal where if you paid a certain amount, you could refill your soda and popcorn all day, and I did. And the thing is, the Oak Street Cinema, the seats they had were still the ones from the 30s, and oh my God, they were so uncomfortable. I would have to, you know, move and switch around and stand up every so often, and you saw other people squirming in their seats, but it didn't matter because we were mesmerized. These films filled the screen. They were huge vistas, long sequences with no dialogue, and I was in love. I was madly in love with these movies to the point where I started looking for more spaghetti westerns. Quentin Tarantino was really big around this time, as was Robert Rodriguez, and they both talked about the spaghetti western so much, and because they talked about it more, more would come into video stores, to the point where when the DVD thing hit in 2000 and 2001, that's when they really broke big. Young. They were putting out tons of this stuff on DVD, and I've been a huge fan ever since. One of the things I don't buy a lot of the, you know, our 50 films for $30, because a lot of it is public domain and shitty prints. But for the spaghetti westerns, I'm buying them. And some of them look like crap. They look like somebody taped it off TV, or they took somebody's VHS tape and transferred it. But there's no other way to get these movies. A lot of these movies, the U.S. print came, and it would do the Grindhouse, and it would maybe do the drive-in circuit as a second or third film, and then be gone. And they'd be gone. Now, you're going to find more and more nicer versions of them, because there is more interest, especially with Tarantino doing Django Unchained and The Hateful Eight, and there's a lot of attention on the spaghetti western. There's also the Encore Western Channel will show a lot of them. Turner Classic Movies from time to time will show some of the better known ones that they have the rights to. But the spaghetti western itself, the way it started, westerns were one of the genres in Hollywood that was a solid B genre. You could put out a western as a second feature and people would like it, as long as there was a lot of action and you stuck to the tropes of the good guy with the white hat and the bad guy with the black hat, or they were fighting the Indians. And, you know, John Wayne started actually as a singing cowboy. And if you ever see any of those, it's pretty ridiculous to see John Wayne try to pretend he's singing. but it was a huge staple in Hollywood for years and years and years. There would be the prestige ones, you know, the ones that are still shown, a lot of the later John Wayne stuff, John Wayne sort of after World War II, anything by John Ford, things like that, that still have kind of a pedigree. It was like a genre where, for the most part, most of them were disposable B-Westerns with actors that you, unless you're a fan of the genre, don't know, like Randolph Scott or Tom Mix or people like that. But then once television started needing content, a lot of the people who made the B-Westerns started making them for TV. And if you look at the schedules for the networks in the late 50s, early 60s, there were Westerns on every night, because it was a dependable action genre that they knew could pull in a certain audience as long as it was made competently. The old thing, could you hear the actors? Was the screen in focus? Were things lit? All right, do it. And a lot of the people who worked in TV in the early days were the people who worked in B-movies because they knew how to get it done fast. If you look at the Batman 1966 TV show and look at the people who directed them, a lot of them are people who used to do ultra-low budget movies like William One-Shot Bodine. His nickname was One-Shot because it didn't matter what was happening, he only took one shot and moved on so that he could save money and reduce costs. So here in the U.S., the B-Western really sort of faded away, because why go see a Western in the, you know, go pay to see a Western, maybe an actor you know, maybe you don't, when you could stay home and watch an Western for free with actors you've known because they're on TV all the time. However, in Europe, the Western genre was still popular. It had been very popular because action movies are popular all over the world. They're easy to dub. Action is kind of universal, and Hollywood excels at making action films. So the Western genre was still very big in Europe and Northern Africa. So the Italian film industry, which really was pretty much built on whatever's hot, doing a bunch of them. Now, yes, there were the high-end Italian films. But for the most part, when you think of the Italian film industry in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and even into the 80s, they were kind of, what can we do fast that can make money? What was a hit? We're going to do 100 of them. The first Hercules movie with Steve Reeves, big hit. And the biblical epics were really big out of the U.S. So it wasn't long till there were tons and tons of gladiator movies and Hercules type movies and mythical strongman movies and Samson and Delilah, where Samson's a strongman. Those films, and they churned a bunch of them out. But by around 63, 64, that genre was dying. So they started doing Westerns. Now, one of the things as I researched into spaghetti Westerns, no one really has a good handle on what the first one was that could really be classified as a spaghetti Western. There were some European-American co-productions. There were some higher-end productions. But for the most part, if you read a book on spaghetti Westerns, they're going to say that A Fistful of Dollars was the first true spaghetti Western. And while some people dispute with other movies, it's really hard to know. So I'm going to go with what the books have said, that The Fistful of Dollars was the first spaghetti Western. And the plot for Fistful of Dollars was stolen from a Japanese samurai film. A lot of the spaghetti Westerns are, the more complicated ones, their plots are stolen from other places, because it's an exploitation genre. It's get it done, get it fast, get in the theater. And Fistful of Dollars came out in 1964. The other thing about it was, even though it came out in 64, it didn't come to the U.S. till later. And one of the reasons they picked Clint Eastwood is the way the spaghetti Western was marketed and made. They would try to get a star from each of the major countries. They would try to get someone from the U.S. They would try to get someone from Germany. They would have people from Spain because they were mostly shot in Spain. They would want to get an Italian actor or two. If they could get a British actor, they would do that. And part of it was so that they, when they would go and release the movie in that country, they would have that actor's name as the draw. For the U.S., it was Clint Eastwood or Lee Van Cleef or even Henry Fonda, who made a couple. In Germany, it would be Klaus Kinski. Oh my God, Klaus Kinski made so many spaghetti westerns. I'm surprised he had time to do anything else. But they would film it as a silent film. They wouldn't have microphones. They wouldn't have any sort of sound equipment as they filmed. They would film silent and then do it all in the dubbing. So, okay, bring in the German group, and the German group would dub it. All right, bring in the American group, and the American group would dub it. All right, bring in the Italian group, and the Italian group would dub it, and so on and so on and so on. But like the Italian film industry, Fistful of Dollars came out, was a huge success in Europe, and they immediately started churning out these Westerns for movie theaters who wanted Western product. One of the things about the spaghetti western you learn as you watch them is that they use a lot of the same locations. Most of them are shot Tabernas Desert in the province of Almeria in southeastern Spain. And I am probably really, really, really butchering that. But it's a desert in Spain that, after you've watched a few spaghetti westerns, you recognize it. It kind of looks like the southwest U.S. It has the mountains and the desert. It doesn't have the cactuses. It doesn't have a lot of that. But it substituted well enough. And if you watch a lot of spaghetti westerns, there are certain towns you will always recognize. They had three primary locations they shot these, depending on where you were in the pecking order and what your film company was, but they were called Texas Hollywood, Mini Hollywood, and Western Leone. They also used filming locations in central and southern Italy, some of the parks of Valle di Trecca, which is between Rome and Viterbo. They used places down in the south of Spain, but for the most part, they were all filmed in the Almeria and Alhambra Desert, to the point where I watched one where I got a really good print, and you could see far in the background them filming another Western, because you could see the large, almost mirror-like thing they used to light the set during the day to make the set brighter. And it became a huge industry to the point where they were shooting over 100 a year. Some estimates are that they were making between 200 and 300 a year at the very, very peak. Which, I can't even think of any film genre anywhere other than maybe the Bollywood industry in India, where they're putting out that much product. There was that much hunger for the product. And it was a lot like the American exploitation film, where the movie would play in a theater for a week and then move to the next theater for a week and the next theater for a week and the next theater for a week. In some cases, the film promoter would have the film in his car, go to the theater, say, I'll show this, we'll split the profits. He would actually build the film on their projectors, maybe even run the projectors, stay in the town, he'd get half and they'd get half, and in some cases they would the person who owned the film would even be the one who's doing all the promotion, sort of to make more money. Very, very different from the film industry now, which is they make the prints, the distributor ships the prints, everybody gets it at the same time. They even now do digital distribution, where on Thursday, the digital projector just downloads the film based on what's been programmed into it. The person who's running the projector booth, much like in audio, video and audio editing, drops in the trailers And in a lot of cases, because the trailers are the ones the studio wants shown, the trailers are already in there, but they're just dropped in, boom, boom, boom. They program, play the movie at these times, on these days, boom, done. Very different from how it used to be. A lot of indie films, smaller studios are struggling because theaters don't get film anymore, so they have to be able to do digital distribution. Back then, you'd put the film cans in your car and drive to the next theater. And if your movie didn't do well, boy, word of mouth would go pretty fast between theater owners, because it wasn't chains like today. It was, you know, the guy in Macomb, Illinois owned a theater, and then the drive-in in Macomb was owned by a different guy, and the theater in Canton was owned by a different guy, and on and on and on, till slowly the chains bought them all up. The first sort of bracket, when you look at the history of spaghetti westerns, it goes through kind of a genre history, and a lot of genres go through this, especially if there's a boom in that genre. And I've kind of sketched them out for myself. It's the explosion. That's the first one. That's where Fistful of Dollars hits, and they start making tons of these movies. It lasted 4 years. It lasted from 1964 to 1968. There were a lot of very similar themes and very similar plots. A lot of the actors who worked in these made tons of these movies because the money would be so good. Eastwood made three. And by the time they were released in the U.S., he had become a big enough star that he could do movies in the U.S. But there were other people. There were Italian actors like Franco Nero. And Franco Nero is the one that comes to mind the most. Or Terence Hill, who made these movies. They were Italian actors. They might Americanize their name a little bit when they came over here. Lee Van Cleef is one of my favorite examples. Lee Van Cleef had been a kind of a third-tier actor in the 50s. And when roles started drying up, he got out of acting and was actually working painting houses. And you'll see interviews where he says he was a painter. No, he wasn't the one, you know, doing watercolor lilies or portraits. Nope, he was painting houses. And after Fistful of Dollars, Eastwood came back. And what it was, the director, Sergio Leone, was in love with American Westerns. Loved them. Loved anything John Ford ever did. So when Eastwood was going to come home, he told him that he wanted Lee Van Cleef in his next movie. But he had so much trouble getting in touch with him. Well, it's because Lee Van Cleef didn't have an agent anymore. And it's a different world. Getting, you know, being in Italy and trying to get a hold of somebody in the U.S. was a little hard back then. Especially if you didn't have their contact information. You couldn't look them up on Google. And if you didn't have an agent, you couldn't call an agent and go, hey, I want your guy. So when Eastwood came back, he hunted up Lee Van Cleef and told him this. And Van Cleef was like, you know, I'm so tired of the audition process. I'm so tired of, you know, all of this stuff. That's why I got out of acting. And Eastwood said, look at it this way. He's going to pay you this amount of money. You get a vacation in Europe for free on top of getting paid. So Van Cleef came over, was in Fistful of Dollars, was also in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. But if you look at your spaghetti westerns, he's in tons of them because he had been in those two Leone movies. And if you'd been a big-name actor in a Sergio Leone movie, of course, everybody's going to want to use you. And Van Cleef has said that he stayed in Europe way too long. He stayed until the jobs dried up there. Then he came back to the U.S. and got back into acting. And he never really kind of became a huge name in the U.S. He did, you know, TV stuff, second and third tier parts in motion pictures. After being, you know, the number one box office star in Europe for years. But there were a lot of actors who did that. Like I said, Klaus Kinski. He was in so many movies. I can't tell you how many times I'm watching a movie. It's, oh, there's Klaus Kinski. Oh, there he is again. Oh, there. One of the things about the spaghetti western that's different from the U.S. western, I talked a lot about the white hats and the black hats. In the spaghetti western, Motives were more shades of gray. The plots were darker. They were more, I'm not going to say more sophisticated, but they were more on the edge of where the morality wasn't cut and dried. It wasn't black and white. You also had a number of other themes layering over that. Because they were mostly Italian or Italian-Spanish co-productions, as you watch a spaghetti western, you're going to see a lot of Catholic imagery. You're going to see a lot of crosses. You're going to see a lot of churches. You're going to see a lot of people in the crucifixion slash Christ pose, especially if they're the hero and they're at their lowest ebb. You're going to see a lot of that. You're going to see a lot of sort of Dark Ages and Renaissance Catholic imagery in these films, either, you know, right in your face or in the design work, especially when you think about the fact that they're shooting and making these so fast that they can do 200 in a year between all of the different studios. They're churning through plots and they're not taking a lot of time. So a lot of it, to me, feels a lot like Pulp Fiction, where if you're being paid by the word, you're going for quantity and not quality. And a lot of the spaghetti westerns, while some of them are incredibly good, a lot of them are just, okay, it's genre filmmaking, and it's plug this guy in, move it along, plug this guy in, move it along, take this old plot, plug this in. Another thing, if you look at a lot of American westerns, the hero is the sheriff or the put upon farmer or the young man who comes to town and is going to clean things up, or a lawman or something. In the spaghetti western, it's not like that. It's more ambiguous. You had a lot of bounty hunters, You had a lot of people seeking revenge. Most of the plots were around bounty hunters, except they called them bounty killers. You had a lot of violence, a lot of the, even if the sheriff was in the movie, it was rare that the sheriff was the hero. The sheriff was usually an obstacle. The law was usually an obstacle. You had tons and tons and tons of revenge plot lines where a person's family had been killed, or his land had been destroyed, or he'd been cheated out of something. One of the plots I find very interesting is a group of bandits who steal something, and then they cheat one of the bandits, who then wants to get his share and revenge along the way. The spaghetti western was also much, much more violent than the United States westerns. A lot more gunplay, a lot more people being killed. It is not uncommon for a character to be introduced. You get some of their backstory and they're killed within 5 to 10 minutes. You get to know the character and they die. As the genre went on and restrictions on what you could show opened up, the spaghettis were really, they had no problem with blood flying or torture or scenes like that. There's in one of the movies that I really love, it's a really good movie called Death Rides a Horse, when the protagonist is captured by the villains and they're about to leave, they bury him up to his neck in sand and say, if you told us the truth, we'll come back and we'll dig you out. If you didn't, you will stay there until you die of starvation and thirst. And they put water just out of his reach. And this is not an uncommon thing in the spaghetti western. Things like that you would not see in an American western. They would not have done that sort of thing in, you know, even a B-movie, let alone the TV stuff that they were doing. Another of the themes that was around in a lot of these movies, although it was a theme that was kind of touched on, but as the genre went on and as time went on and the world was kind of in this 60s upheaval, there was a lot of stuff around revolution. Even if there's a revolution, the Mexican Revolution is in the background, or the Civil War is in the background, as you got further into the 60s and the early 70s, it went from that being in the background to that being in the foreground to that being the main plot about, are these revolutionaries good or evil? Is a revolution good in and of itself? Or people who are using the revolution to get what they want. They're using the young idealists to take money or to get revenge or to get the women or whatever the plot is. But it stuck to themes, especially revenge. Most spaghetti westerns, if you watch it, are either, you know, your hero is the smartest guy in the room trying to steal a bunch of gold, or he's trying to steal gold back, or he's trying to get gold back, or he's out for revenge. Revenge is huge in the spaghetti western, whereas in the U.S. western, it's more about justice. It's more about, you know, the Black Bart has to pay for the crimes he has done, rather than Black Bart has to die at my hands for what he did. A big cultural difference. Then in around 1968, 69, the genre had been around for a while and it wasn't doing as well. It started on the downward slide. The box office returns weren't as great. Sergio Leone, the Fistful of Dollars, Few Dollars More, and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly had been released in the U.S. to moderate to success. For their cost, they made a lot of money. But then when they made it to TV, they were huge. I said The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly was shown on the ABC Sunday Night Movie. It was shown more than once. It was shown a lot. And as a kid, I do remember some of the bigger spaghetti westerns actually being shown in the afternoons on Peoria TV stations. It'd be, you know, here's a Sunday afternoon western, and it would be a spaghetti western, which, you know, my dad or my grandfather, you know, my uncle would go, oh, this is one of those spaghetti westerns. I didn't know what they meant by spaghetti western. But the genre had been around long enough that it had saturated the market, so it started to change. First off, Sergio Leone came to the U.S. to do the Once Upon a Time in the West. And when he came to the U.S., because of the strength of the Dollars trilogy, they said, where do you want to shoot your film? And Leone said, I want to shoot wherever it was John Ford shot. John Ford, the director who did Stagecoach, who did The Searchers, who did all those wonderful westerns. When you think of the good John Wayne westerns of the 40s, 50s, and even into the 60s, you're thinking John Ford as director. And he wanted to shoot in those areas. One of the problems was when Once Upon a Time in the West came out, Paramount thought it would be much bigger than it actually was. It did mediocre. And it's hard to know because a lot of this was, you know, it's not like today where they, here's what movies did over the weekend. Leone was told that it lost money. However, Paramount has made a whole lot of money off it ever since. And he went back to Italy and made a couple other movies. He did Duck, You Sucker, which is a very underrated film with James Coburn about the Mexican Revolution. And it was Leone's take on what was going on in the U.S. and in Europe with the youth protests and the government overthrows and the Vietnam War, and his take on what revolution really meant and the price of revolution for the normal citizen. He also was involved in another movie, and there are rumors as to how much of the movie he directed. It's very clear to me that I know he directed the big sequences because you could tell Leone's work, but it's hard to say what he directed. And the name of the movie is My Name is Nobody, and it's Terrence Hill playing a variation of his Trinity character, which I'll talk about in a minute, and Henry Fonda. And the plot of the movie is Henry Fonda is a gunfighter who was the best in all the world, and he's wanting to go away. His time is done. He wants to make it to New Orleans and get on a boat and go away before some young kid kills him, because he's the best, so everyone challenges him. And Terrence Hill is the person who kind of tags along, letting him know that he thinks of him as a legend. And to me, the interesting thing about that, it's Leone's take on the end of the American Western. It's set early 1900s, so there are cars and other things. Henry Fonda was older at the time, so he was able to portray that sort of genre that's passing. And Terence Hill, who is playing, you know, the Italian Western type, but also very reverent to the Henry Fonda character, as Leone was very reverent to the American Western genre. A lot changed during this period of decline in that the Western comedy, the spaghetti Westerns, moved more toward comedy, especially after My Name is Trinity came out. And My Name is Trinity was Terence Hill, who'd done a lot of much darker movies. But this was sort of a slapstick comedy-style Western, and it did very well, especially in Europe, but here in the U.S., it actually gained a following to the point where I dated a woman for a while, and her father was a huge fan of the Trinity movies, to the point where he would every so often talk about how, you know, they need to make another one of those. Why haven't they made one? And the thing was, the two legit Trinity movies did well, and then Terence Hill made a lot of buddy cop comedies and other comedies with his partner Bud Spencer, and they would just move from genre to genre to genre. Most of them would be cop movies or movies like that through the 70s that never made it to the U.S. until basically somebody wanted to put out a Trinity set. And they redubbed all of the movies to say they were Trinity, even though it's Trinity as a cop in Italy. There were also more splintered subgenres, and diversity grew during this time. The violence became more. I talked a little about how they moved more into social commentary on the revolution by really focusing on the Mexican Revolution of the 1800s. You had mixing of genres. You had some horror. You had some comedy. You had some espionage. The Sabata movies had a lot of James Bondish type elements, as did a series that there were tons of movies in called Satana. And the Satana movies had titles like, you know, Pray to Live, Satana Will Be Your Death, that sort of thing. Sartana. But Sartana had a lot of James Bond-like gimmicks set in the West. And it's one of the things about the spaghetti Western where if a movie would be successful, no one had any qualms about ripping it off. There have been two Django movies, two official Django movies. There was Django and then a sequel in the 80s, both with Franco Nero. But if you look, there are tons and tons and tons of what they call unofficial Django sequels. And a lot of them are just, they took a spaghetti Western and said, oh, his name is Django as well. And it's the same with Sartana. With Sartana, the box set I have has over 20 movies. Only three or four were made by any of the same people involved in the first one. And they also have a movie that came out before the first Sartana movie where the antagonist in the movie is named Sartana. Well, it says Sartana, so we renamed it. It's one of the things I miss about the Italian film industry, how they didn't care. They just didn't fucking care. They just didn't care. They were going to rip you off, and they didn't care. They would use your character's name. Oh, this is Django versus Sartana. This is Django versus it's this guy. The fistful of this. On and on and on and on and on. And in some ways, I find it really fascinating how they did that. But in others, it poisoned the well. Oh, I like Django. Now I go see this movie. Well, that's nothing like Django. This one's kind of boring, and it doesn't... I'll go to the next one. And by, you know, after a while, it's a Django movie. I want nothing to do with that. And in a lot of ways, when I was a kid, that's how we saw sequels. Sequels were, you know, kind of a crappier version of the first one. And if you look at sequels in the 70s, except for a few, you know, Godfather 2, But French Connection too. Well, no, nothing like French Connection. Not as good. Maybe it had Gene Hackman in it, but it wasn't as good. Or The Exorcist 2, which was god-awful, horrible, horrible nightmare. Or Jaws 2, which was just a crappier version with more blood. Sequels had a bad name because it was the way sequels were in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Now in the 30s and 40s, it was different because they would do film series. We're going to do Blondie. We're going to do a new Blondie movie every 3 months because you didn't have TV, so they had movie series. But those were pretty much gone. And when you look at that time period, especially with the spaghetti western, there were movie came out, if it made money, there were tons of horrible quote sequels unquote. So by 1971, the genre was pretty much dying. The humor had worn out. They were still making them, but by then they were sort of sputtering and on their last legs. They would have a samurai in the West. They would do horror westerns. They would do, you know, trying to recapture that, basically trying to sort of bring back the genre because, hey, I've been working in this. I know how to do this. We still have the sets. We still have this. And really by 1973-74, it was gone. Some would come out very sporadically, but The Exorcist had come out and made a lot of money, so the Italian film industry turned to doing horror and movies about Satan and movies about possession and movies about exorcism because that was the hot genre. Then after Jaws, they went to monsters. You know, not giant grizzly bears and piranha and things like that. The last spaghetti western, legit spaghetti western, that got any release in the U.S. only got released because it was a 3D movie. And there was a 3D movie that came out, I was in high school when it came out, called Coming At Ya. And when I watched, if you watch the trailer, you have no idea it's a western. And you have no idea it's Italian. It's just stuff is coming at the screen. It's 3D like you've never seen before. Oh my gosh, it's 3D. I still have not seen it. I hear it's a fairly mediocre spaghetti western. But yeah, like I said, the genre was pretty dead. However, the genre was very much loved by certain filmmakers. And the first real homage was by Alex Cox, who had directed Repo Man, he had directed Sid and Nancy, and then he did an American spaghetti western called Go to Hell, because he loved the genre so much, and because it tanked so poorly, it's why you don't hear about Alex Cox. He was a director who was really on the rise, and then Go to Hell came out, and sort of ended his mainstream movie career. People weren't ready for it to come back. There wasn't that overwhelming love for it. But then, in the early 90s, you had the rise of Quentin Tarantino, the rise of Robert Rodriguez, the rise of these indie directors who had a deep affection for the grindhouse genre, but also were able to turn it and spin it and make it artsy. Pulp Fiction, if you look at the plot, it's very much the plot of low-budget movies, basically exploitation film. It's an exploitation film ramped up, made well, with crackling dialogue, basically taking the sort of stuff that was in the exploitation film genre and turning it into art. And because Tarantino had such a love of spaghetti westerns and would talk about them in interviews, Robert Rodriguez, the same thing, Desperado, Once Upon a Time in Mexico. They have that affection, that love, and they would put it out there. That's when the genre begins to come back to the point now where you're getting more and more things set in that sort of spaghetti western feel. Django Unchained, The Hateful Eight. More and more attention is being paid to the genre. Another thing that's really interesting to me is how when Clint Eastwood came to the U.S., most of his early films after his Dollars trilogy were sort of American versions of the spaghetti western. Hang 'em High, on like that, to the point where whenever he does westerns, you've got that sense of the spaghetti western in that he's not your white hat, baby face, white meat hero. He's usually morally ambiguous, to the point where the last western he did, Unforgiven, if you watch Unforgiven, you can see it as a sequel to the Dollars trilogy. Even though the Dollars trilogy, it's not the same character, it's not the same time period. It's because Clint Eastwood, in all of them, they don't give him a name. His name is never said, so people see it as a trilogy. He wore the same costume and etc., etc. If you watch Unforgiven, it is a thematic sequel to those films. The former gunslinger who's settled down, put his guns away, and now has to come back to right a wrong. When you get to the spaghetti western, there are tons of them. I think I've talked about how you can go on Amazon and there are sets and sets and sets. I recently picked up a set that was 44 spaghetti westerns for $20 on I don't know how many discs. And a lot of it is, basically, they're public domain. Because they were exploitation, because they were like that. Even the ones that were brought over by bigger studios like Paramount and United Artists and MGM, they just bought them, brought them over, ran them as a bottom half of one of their double features, and then just let the patent or copyright, they just let the copyright expire. Because, okay, these are too violent to sell to TV at the time. Now, boom, they're done. We don't care. So what I wanted to do was kind of give the listener a good kind of starting place where you can, 10 movies that you can use as kind of your start into the world of the spaghetti western. So I've got 10 here. I've got 10 really good examples. There will be many, many more examples. I could go on with more and more. The first three are, of course, the Dollars trilogy, the ones that everybody knows. Fistful of Dollars, Few Dollars More, and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. It's Clint Eastwood. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly may be one of my five favorite films ever made. It has the most beautiful soundtrack ever, but it also just is so beautifully photographed. Leone and his cinematographer make the screen look huge. If you're going to watch it in widescreen. Do not watch it pan and scanned. Always watch it letterboxed, so that you can see, because he filled the screen with the long focus shots and so many scenes without any dialogue. The huge gunfight at the end of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, not a single word is said until the gunfight is over. It's all done with gesture and people looking and physical acting. It's not words. Leone was beautiful at doing that, not just for the genre and for the fact that he was making movies that would be in other countries, but he understood the language of film in a way that very, very few people do. Every Leone Western is well worth watching. Like I said, there's Fistful of Dynamite, Once Upon a Time in the West, which my friend Tommy, who's more of a film fanatic than I am, that's the one spaghetti western he loves above more than any other, and he even says that that's his favorite western. And then My Name is Nobody, even though Leone didn't completely direct it, he directed scenes, and it's very ambiguous as to what he did as producer. But Leone's, the Dollars trilogy is where you should start. That's where you're going to learn about the genre with kind of the most mainstream of the films. The next one I would suggest is Django. There is a reason that Quentin Tarantino chose Django as the name of his character. Django starts with a man stumbling through mud, dragging a coffin behind him. And the movie is about what's in the coffin, why he's doing this, the town he goes into. And it is a movie where you will see the difference between an American Western and a spaghetti Western. The moral ambiguity, the fact that the heroes don't always win, the fact that the innocent are never safe, the fact that bad things can happen. There are a number of sequels, including a sort of legitimate sequel that was made in 88. I have not even made a dent in them. But after Django, there is, usually they call it the sequel Django Kill. It's not a sequel. It's a very different movie. It's almost a surrealist film. So it's very, very different. Make sure when you're watching Django. With Franco Nero. Do not fall for any of the imitators. The next one I would bring up is Death Rides a Horse. It's a Lee Van Cleef movie. It's about a young man whose family is killed, and he spends the rest of his life looking for revenge. However, he also meets up with Lee Van Cleef, who had been with the killers, had taken the fall for some of the crimes they committed, and is just now getting out of jail. So he's searching for revenge, as well as this young man searching for revenge. And it's the genre of the expert teaching and guiding the young man. Beautiful imagery in this movie, too. And for such a dark subject, Van Cleef does bring humor. It also shows that Lee Van Cleef was a much better actor than he gets credit for. He's really good in this film. And the visuals of the film are just... Make sure you get a good print. There are a lot of crappy prints out there. The one they show on Turner Classic Movies is a beautiful print. Very clean, very bright. I don't know if they've done restoration on it, but it's just a joy to watch that version. I mentioned A Fistful of Dynamite. A Fistful of Dynamite is sort of thought of as the least of Leone's films. I completely disagree. I think Fistful of Dynamite is a beautiful meditation on the 60s. I was a wee child in the 60s, so most of the knowledge I have of the 60s is from reading about it. But it's set during the Mexican Revolution. It takes place in and around the Mexican Revolution, and it's Leone's take on how the people who are in charge of a revolution treat the innocents, how they become their own sort of version of an establishment. James Coburn is brilliant in this film. He's just as good as Eastwood is in the Dollars trilogy. It's a very underrated film, and I hope that if nothing else happens with this podcast, a few more people watch this film. It's a very political film and a very good political film. The next one I have is The Return of Sabata. I love The Return of Sabata. I have the Sabata trilogy. The first one is okay. The second one with Yul Brynner. Yul Brynner does not do a good job. Yul Brynner's could have been... let's just say that if they would have had a cardboard cutout of Yul Brynner, there are scenes that wouldn't have made any difference. But Return of Sabata opens with this beautiful, surreal, hyper-colored circus sequences. Sabata is a trick shot artist, but there are all these different circus acts going on, and that does play a part later in the film. The music is very good, is why I chose it for the theme, but also it's much like Morricone, it fits the film beautifully, and it's got humor, it's got kind of over-the-top action. Really a joy to watch. It's a very fun film to watch, which is... A lot of the spaghetti westerns are interesting, and I think they're good movies, but many of them I can't say that they're fun. Django is not a fun movie. You will get to the end of the movie, and you will kind of not want to talk to anybody for a while. I've seen some other spaghetti westerns that end with, and then the hero is killed by the villains, and the villains kill everyone in the town because they have won the end. There's a nihilistic streak through a lot of these spaghetti westerns because it was a European audience that really, Europeans didn't need the happy ending like Americans do. Americans need a happy ending. Europeans, especially after the French New Wave and the Italian New Wave and those art movements, were open to darker endings. There was also the Japanese films that had come in, which have very much ambiguous endings for a lot of their films. So the spaghetti western genre broke away from the U.S. where the good guy wins and the bad guy dies or goes to prison. Nope. So you need to be prepared for that. Django Kill, I talked about a little earlier. I talked about My Name is Nobody. And the last one I want to bring up is if you meet Sartana, pray for your death. As I said, there are probably over 50 films with Sartana in the title, or a character named Sartana as the lead character. Sartana was kind of a Western James Bond. He had trick guns, he had gadgets, he had gimmicks. The plots were usually around either getting revenge or him coming to town to wipe out the bad guys. But the thing about the Sartana movies was because he was kind of portrayed as much smarter than everybody in the room, he would almost seem like a mystic force who has come to town to rid the town of whatever evil there is. He would pop up in certain places and they wouldn't explain how he got there. He would know things then. You would infer he found them out somehow, but the filmmaker doesn't bother to tell you, so that he almost feels like he has knowledge beyond, which was something kind of unique in the spaghetti western, because they really, until you got to the decline of the genre, they really tried to be more realistic than American westerns. They really tried to be that layer of the American westerns are cleaned up and sanitized. This is how life really is. As you can tell, I am a huge fan of the spaghetti western. I've been talking about them for an hour. I like talking about things like this. Are there any subjects like this that you would want me to talk about? If so, you can email me at corey.strode@gmail.com, subject Solitaire Rose Radio. I am wanting to interview people, both in comics and if they have interesting stories, but I also like going into these things that I enjoy. We're going to be doing these every week this summer, and because we're doing it every week this summer, we're really pushing the ads, so here are our advertisers. Pretty much every form of entertainment has advertising, and this one is no different. Our first ad is for DreamHost.com. DreamHost.com is the best web host in the whole known universe. I've been using them for 14 years. They've always been able to help. They have great services. If you need a web page, they are the best. Just go to DreamHost.com, and if you use the code CRAZY, that's K-R-A-Y-Z, you get $20 off your first year. Our second advertiser is Graze.com. Graze.com is healthy snacks delivered right to your door so that when you're at work, you can avoid the vending machine. When you're home, you don't have to reach for the bag of chips. It's dried fruit. It's new ideas. I get it every 2 weeks, but you could get it more often. Great food at a great price. And if you use the reward code CORYS3R5P, your first and fifth boxes are free. That's CORYS3R5P. And if you're listening to this here podcast, you're one of the most good-looking people on the internet, and you don't want to trust your skin to just any old razor, so shave with the amazing razors you get from Dollar Shave Club. Every month, they send a box with your shave supplies at the beginning of the week, or whenever you want. You can pop in a fresh blade and get that fresh blade shave. It feels fantastic, and it's just one of the many ways that you can maintain the good looks that everyone has come to expect from you. That's Dollar Shave Club. If you go to dollarshaveclub.com/crazy, it kicks a little back. All of these advertisers, they kick a little back to us, so we can wet our beak a little. We're not asking for much. We're not asking you for money. But if you need these things, go to our advertisers. They support this podcast. Thanks.
Hello, universe.
My name is Brian.
And I'm Emily.
I'm her dad.
And I'm his daughter.
I like to try strange new foods.
And I don't.
She loves to listen to Taylor Swift and dance.
And he doesn't.
But we both like...
video games!
Comic books!
Wrestling!
Superhero movies!
Fun facts!
But most of all...
YouTube!
So we put together a channel...
where we could try new things and talk about fun ideas.
We called it Hey Poindexters.
And we put a new episode up every week.
So pay us a visit.
You never know what we're gonna do next.
Search for Hey Poindexters on YouTube or visit heypoindexters.com for more information.
Through the end of August, you're going to get a new Solitaire Rose Radio every week. We still are finishing up the Jack Kirby series. We're getting into the EC series. We're going to be having Mad next week. Yep, we're going to do the first five issues of Mad with my friend Tommy Lang, who was Uncle Ghouli on Horror Incorporated. He is, I'm not going to call him an expert on Harvey Kurtzman, but he knows more about Harvey Kurtzman than I do. And I really studied a lot of EC. Huge Mad fan, especially of the comic book. I think you're going to really like that interview, that discussion. But we've still got more Tales from the Crypt. We've got all the EC books to go. And I'm looking at some other histories of things to do. I'm looking at some other things that I want to get into in depth, kind of like how I went in depth on Marvel's New Universe and the... Marvel's New Universe from the 80s and early 90s. So if you have suggestions, things in comics that you'd like me to dig into and research and talk about, just let me know. I want to thank you for listening. Thank you for downloading. And I really want to thank you for the opportunity to let me experiment with Solitaire Rose Radio. I think if you're going to do a solo podcast, if I'm just going to do the same thing over and over and over, it's not going to be as fun as I'm having doing these. So I want to thank you for listening. I'll just let you know that I'll be back next week with more stories.